Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of the troubled regions of the Caucasus that the accused Boston bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev visited for 6 months last year after Russian intelligence had flagged him and asked the FBI to look into his possible ties to radical Islam. One of the country's leading experts on Russian-Chechen relations and the Caucasus, Gordon Hahn, joins us to discuss the extent of cooperation between Russian and American intelligence services and the history of this troubled, war-torn region and how it might have influenced the actions of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Then on Earth Day, we will look into how none of the world's top industries would be profitable if they paid for the natural capital they use. We will speak with Daphne Wysham, the director of the Genuine Progress Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is working on ways to build a more sustainable society by using the Genuine Progress Indicator, which Maryland and Vermont have adopted as an alternative metric to the Gross Domestic Product, or GDP, to move beyond a system that simply steals from the future, sells it in the present, and calls it GDP. And joining us now is Gordon Hahn, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. His books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Hahn.
Thank you.
And you have been studying for a long time Russia's Islamic Threat, if you will, from within. And the leader of the Chechen opposition, of course, is hiding out in London. Ahmed Zakayev has gone public and said that the Boston bombings by these two Chechen brothers are a gift to Vladimir Putin. Do you think he's right?
I wouldn't say it's much of a gift to Vladimir Putin because President Putin's going to be facing his own challenge when the Olympics come up in about, 10 months from now? So he's going to have to secure the Sochi Olympics, which Sochi's located in the North Caucasus, and it's a few hours' drive from some of the centers of jihadi activity to the Olympics. So I don't think, if there's a gift, he won't be enjoying that gift very long.
Well, it's worth, at least getting some of the history. It's a terrible and tortured history. The Chechens, of course, Stalin removed them entirely, and then they sort of had to kind of crawl back and fight their way back to their homeland after, I think, a third of them were wiped out by Stalin just from the gulags and from dispossession. And then in the more recent period, when all the other republics, when the Soviet Union collapsed, when they all got independence, the Chechens wanted it too, and they won a rather brutal war, but that was very brief. And, of course, in the 1990s, in that war, groups of Arab jihadists joined in the fight. And then, of course, famously, it was Vladimir Putin who, following the rather mysterious bombings of apartment buildings outside of Moscow, was able to conduct a second Chechen war, which he did largely using the armies of the intelligence service, and with utter ruthlessness, he crushed the second Chechen rebellion, killing as many as 200,000 Chechens in a scorched earth policy, and they at times wanted to negotiate a peace and he would have no part of it. And he's installed his kind of puppet regime at the moment, right? Is that a fair brief sketch, historical sketch?
I'd say that it's a little one-sided. There are a couple of things that are skipped over. There's no doubt that there was a very tragic history for the Chechen people up through the period of the end of the Soviet Union. However, at the end of the Soviet Union, yes, it's true that Chechen wanted independence. Like many of the other Union republics. The problem is that Chechnya did not have Union republic status. It, like many other republics inside the Russian Federation, not the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, had the opportunity to negotiate autonomy from Moscow, not full independence, but autonomy. Some 46 regions across Russia managed to do that successfully, including all of the titular Muslim republics. The only region that did manage to do that successfully was the Chechens. One of the reasons for that is that the Chechens, the Chechen nationalists, were very radical. They refused to negotiate with Moscow. President Dudayev refused to meet with Yeltsin unless Yeltsin recognized him as the head of an independent state. Dudayev made terrorist threats before the first war. Shamil Basayev traveled to the al-Qaeda camps before the first war. So Moscow was dealing with a very radical nationalist movement in Chechnya, and I think someone needs to question the leadership of Dzhokhar Dudayev, who decided that he could challenge a fairly still capable Russian army and start a first war for independence after seizing power illegally and so forth. Now, one can argue about the legality in terms of whether Soviet power in general was legal and whether, therefore, the Russian Federation was a legal entity. But again, everyone else managed to come to a compromise with Moscow. It was only the Chechens and even their fellow Vinok people, the Ingush, refused to participate in the nationalist revolt against Moscow and separated from Chechnya.
So
that's the first point. Yeah. I could probably continue along.
You should, because you're definitely correcting me here.
Uh-huh. The next point is that I guess we should get to the beginning of the Second War. The Second War was largely driven by the foreign jihadi elements that came into the North Caucasus in the period between the two wars. And that was financed and funded and in large degree staffed by al-Qaeda and other groups similar to al-Qaeda. The most important was a famous international jihadist, a man by the name of Ibn Hattab. And there's some question. He was certainly at one point a member of al-Qaeda, a colleague of Osama bin Laden. Some have questioned questioned those ties. But the fact of the matter is, after Hattab was killed, Osama bin Laden wrote a eulogy to Hattab. So clearly, he had a good relationship in general with Osama bin Laden. He was leading and setting up the training camps in the North Caucasus.
Wasn't a lot of the financing, though, coming from wealthy Saudis? Because my understanding is that the description of the Chechen rebels, the commonly used word is Wahhabi.
Right. Well, the Chechen rebels don't use that term for themselves.
No, but I mean, that's what the Russians use.
But if you look at court documents from trials of the Benevolent International Foundation, the Al-Haramain organization, which funded money to both Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and Chechnya, you read those documents, and in those documents, they always mention three entities together, sending money or whatever, equipment, whatever, to Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Chechnya. Everywhere in those documents, those three groups are mentioned together. In one of the documents of a court trial here in the United States, I think the Benevolence Foundation, they found that 42% of the funding of the American-based Benevolent International Foundation was going to Chechnya. Well, that means probably more than both Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the Chechens, were receiving. They funded Hattab. Hattab trained several thousand fighters in the mountains in Chechnya during the interwar period. And then they formed an organization and actually made several attempts to help a group of radical Salafists gain independence inside Dagestan. Then they formed an organization called, I believe, something like the Congress of Chechnya and Dagestan. And they declared their intention to liberate Dagestan and create a Sharia law-based state in Dagestan. So when the invasions occurred by the Mujahideen into Dagestan from Chechnya occurred in September 1999, it was hardly a surprise. There was nothing shocking about this, and it also throws into doubt the interpretation made by many that Putin decided to explode the apartment buildings in Moscow and in Volgodonsk. Because he needed a reason to rally the country against the Mujahideen. When in fact, if these guys, several thousand fighters, already invaded your country, you already have a reason. Don't need to blow up your own people to get another one. So there's that seems the actual reasoning behind the actual cause behind the apartment bombings is very, very murky, to say the least.
So tell me, though, when you talk about the benevolence group, you're giving me the impression that somehow that the Chechen rebels were funded here in the United States. I thought that the money came from Saudi Arabia.
They came from all over the world. The Benevolent International Foundation had offices in Grozny, in the United States, all over the world.
Right, but the percentage that came from the United States would be insignificant compared to the Saudis, surely.
That's hard to tell. I wouldn't say insignificant. It would certainly be less. But nonetheless, this shows the nature of this global jihadi revolutionary movement, which is in part, yes, supported by the Saudis.
So then take us up to the present here. And, of course, I'm speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. His books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. He's taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. So, obviously, we're talking about the Chechen War because of the fact that two Chechen brothers appear to have been the perpetrators of the monstrous mayhem in Boston, the killing of four people, the bombing of three, and shutting down a major American city for a couple of days. There's no question in terms of asymmetrical warfare. They've had an enormous impact. The older brother, who appears to have been more involved in both Chechen politics and having been there, he, according to U.S. travel documents, he arrived in Moscow's airport on January the 12th of 2012 and returned on the 17th of July after having spent time in Machkala, Dagestan, all that summer. But prior to that, of course, Russian intelligence had sent an inquiry to the FBI asking them to interview him because they thought that he was a problem, presumably. Russian intelligence had intercepted Tamerlan Zanarev, who was looking at Chechen radical websites, and the FBI apparently gave him a clean bill of health. So my question is, why would the Russians let the guy in?
There is incompetence in the Russian police forces, especially in the North Caucasus. There's also corruption. So you can't expect them to have a stranglehold on the situation there. You know, we have our own problems here with the FBI apparently having missed some things about this guy. Incidentally, are now some reports that the postings that were removed from Tamerlan's YouTube page show him with photographs of a leading Dagestani, not him sitting next to this emir, but with a leading Dagestani emir of what is called the Rabbani Kala sector of the Vilayet of Dagestan, which is the Dagestani network in the Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen. And these were removed from his site somewhere around mid-February 2013, which would suggest that he might have removed those to avoid any suspicion as he was preparing to carry out this terrorist attack in Boston. There's also a report on the Daily Mail that that Tamerlan met with this Amir Abu Dujan, Dujan of the Rabbina Kali sector, six times while he was in Dagestan. Whether those reports are reliable is not clear, but similar reports came from through Fox News citing government sources yesterday. The reports specifically about him removing these materials from his website, which were linked to the Dagestan Vilayet's website, something I look at every day called the vdagestan.com.
Well, my understanding is that the father and the mother, of course, are in denial, probably.
Yes.
And they said that he spent the whole 6 months sleeping and reading the Quran.
Right.
But an aunt apparently has told the Guardian of the UK that, no, he was out and about and visiting mosques, etc. So not,
right.
Obviously that's in no way a criminal activity. But, of course, there was a phone conversation on Friday between Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. What do you think is going on with those two? And what level of cooperation is there between the United States and Russia on this issue? Because as far as I know, Putin has been pretty hostile to the United States, and he's a former KGB officer. So I imagine just as an institution, the SVR, Foreign Intelligence, and the FSB, Domestic Intelligence, still see America not as a friend but as a rival, if not an enemy.
As a rival, for the most part, yes, that's true. Many and some see them as an enemy. I don't think Putin sees the United States as an enemy. I think he sees us as being a competitor, perhaps a slightly incompetent one and a slightly arrogant one. For example, this is, I think, one reason why he's very concerned about the situation surrounding Syria, because there are now many Chechen fighters fighting with the jihadi wing of the rebel movement in Syria against the Assad regime, and they could very well get their hands on weapons of mass destruction or materials to make weapons of mass destruction. And that's not a good thing to be happening on the basically the eve of the Olympics. And if you take a look at the map, you'll see that the distance from there's a nice little triangle formed between Sochi, Syria, and the North Caucasus that doesn't encompass a whole lot of territory. So this is of great concern, and he basically sees the United States as making the mistake of backpacking the Sunni Muslims against the Shiites. And in a general strategic sense, the Russians could be very well, in the long term, be very well right about this, because Sunnis far outnumber the Shiites. So they're a much greater potential threat than the Shiites ever will be, putting aside, you know, the issue with Iran's attempts to get a nuclear bomb. So in the long term, the Russians actually may be right. Now, they may be making these claims for their own purposes, but in general, the argument is not something that should be ignored. Going back to the North Caucasus, I don't know if you'd want to discuss sort of the road from the Second War to the formation of the Caucasus Emirate, because that's really the most important thing for what's going on now, for the context that, you know, that Tamerlan Tsarnaev fell into when he visited Dagestan for 6 months back in 2012.
Well, we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and continue the conversation with Gordon Hahn.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity. Well, each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Sounds so hard. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm continuing the conversation with Gordon Hahn, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. His books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University, Russia. Now, Gordon, you were just saying before the break that you wanted to take us through we talked about the first Chechen War, the second Chechen War, and now you want to talk about what you consider the important chapter, which is the more recent period, encompassing the period that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, that he experienced in his recent trip to Dagestan.
Right. So the Second War basically ends with the defeat of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria, the nationalist independence movement and government that existed in the interwar years, being defeated, being routed on the traditional battlefield. And for a period of about 6 or 7 months, the command of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria forces is completely diffused and confused, and they can't make contact. Finally, in the summer of 2002, they hook up in the mountains of the North Caucasus, and they hold a shura. That shura is attended by several foreign mujahideen, And at that shura, they decide to jihadize the movement. They require that all decisions taken by the new president of the Chechen Republic, which carries Aslan Maschadov, who is also a former Soviet military commander like Dudayev, be taken in accordance with the Quran and the Sunnah. And he appoints a designated successor and head of the Sharia committee of the Shura, a man by the name of Abdul Halim Sandulayev, who is the person who's going to interpret whether Masharov's decisions coincide with the Quran and the Sunnah. They also begin to establish combat jamaats, not just in Chechnya, but across the North Caucasus. And Maschadov apparently agreed at this meeting to move in the direction of establishing an Islamic state, because a letter was published on one of the Caucasus Emirate websites a few years ago, written by Maschadov to Udugov, who was considered the person who was sort of the ideologue of Islamism within the Chechen Republic Karia movement, in which it's Maschadov who's telling Udugov that he's decided to go in the direction of Islamism, and he wants Udugov to come with him. So whether because he felt the only way he could survive, because the strongest forces were the Islamists, or whether he felt just under pressure, it appears that he decided to move in that direction. So they begin to establish combat jamaats across the North Caucasus, in Ingushetia, in Kabardino-Balkaria. And over time, by 2005, Maschadov is killed in March 2005. And this leaves Sadulayev, who's now the emir, or the president, and Shamil Basayev. Shamil Basayev announces in January 2006 that they will convene a shura of ulemas, Islamic scholars, in summer 2006, and declare Sadulayev the emir of the entire North Caucasus. This is the first step towards the creation of a jihadist movement within the region. However, Sadulayev and Basayev are killed in June and July 2006. So that announcement, the creation of the Caucasus Emirate, doesn't come until October 2007, when Doko Umarov announces the Caucasus Emirate, disbands the entire Chechen Republic Chariot, denouncing it as a secular form of leadership. He declares jihad on all countries fighting Muslims anywhere in the world, and specifically mentions the United States, Great Britain, and Israel. Then, in the course of 2007, they begin to expand their network. From the period 2007 to 2010, it's the English Republic that's actually the spearhead of the jihad. There are more attacks occurring in Ingushetia than anywhere else. However, in spring 2010, that shifts. And since spring 2010, since April 2010, approximately 60 to 70% of the attacks every month are carried out in Dagestan. Most recent qadis of the Sharia court of the Caucasus Emirate have been ethnic Dagestanis. So the Dagestanis have essentially risen to the top of the movement. And Umarov's health is not particularly good, so odds are that the next emir will be Dagestani. So that's a general overview of the development of the Caucasus Emirate since 2007.
So, Gordon Hunt, let's then talk about the broader issues of how Russia and the former Soviet Union has dealt with the Islamist threat. And you've, of course, written about it in your book, Russia's Islamic Threat. Of course, during the communist period, all of those areas were heavily secularized, and religion was a sort of afterthought. And, of course, the Orthodox Church has come back with a vengeance almost immediately that the Soviet Union collapsed. So I take it equally true, the mosques and Islam has come back. But one of the odd things is that the U.S., of course, has been, let's go back to Afghanistan, we used the jihadis to fight the Russians to pay them back for them supporting the North Vietnamese. And my understanding is that Gorbachev, seeing the end when they're about to pull out of Afghanistan, tried to work with the Reagan administration. You know, that was the period when they were ending the Cold War. And he was warning about the idea that the U.S. had stirred up a hornet's nest by hiring these jihadis, and this would come back to bite us. And we all know, of course, about blowback and bin Laden and all of that. So have the Russians been more astute in recognizing this problem than we have?
In terms of Afghanistan, yes. I mean, there were warnings even in the early 1990s from the Russians about the rise of al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and this is one of the reasons why they were backing the Northern Alliance and the Rabbani government against the Taliban. So, I think in terms of Afghanistan and Central Asia, they've been South Asia, they've been, somewhat more on target than we have on occasion. Yeah, I would agree with that.
But they're also more ruthless, are they not, than we are?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. When they carry the general approach now is they're no longer a scorched earth policy. By the way, the numbers I think you gave earlier about 200,000 people being killed in the two wars is probably an overstatement. It's probably no more than 100,000, but that's still a great tragedy for the people. Counter-terrorist operations now are carried out sometimes fairly in a controlled fashion, and other times in a recluse fashion that kills innocent people who are not Mujahideen, who happen to be in the in the locality, and the Russians don't take particular care to avoid the civilian casualties. There are police house-to-house and military house-to-house searches that lead to quite a bit of brutality. There's police brutality when if you get arrested for any kind of a violation in anywhere, really, in Russia. There was a case in Tatarstan about a year ago in which they raped some guy with a broken bottle and killed him in a Tatarstan police station. It had nothing to do with fighting jihadism or Islam. It's just the brutality of policing in general in Russia.
Go back to Tolstoy, Gordon Hahn, there's also this tremendous prejudice against the Muslims. The Russian word for Chechen is Chonya, isn't it, which is the equivalent of the N-word in describing African-Americans.
Well, it's actually, that's a bit of an overstatement. There is considerable prejudice against Chechens and Azeris and some people from the North Caucasus. But regarding Muslims in general, no. Russians tend to get along very well with Tatars and Bashkirs, and that's really not an issue, though there are some tensions in Tatarstan between the Tatar and ethnic Russian community.
Sure. But they're Islamic, by the way.
Tatars are Muslims, right.
Yeah.
But some of that is driven by radical Tatar nationalists. It's not where the Russian community in Tatarstan is trying to lord it over the Tatars. In fact, it's more the reverse, where the Tatars are acting in a prejudiced way against Russians and keeping them from certain kinds of employment and so forth, and employment in government. So it's really a very mixed picture of Russia's historical relation with Muslims. Basically, the approach has been is to try to put reins on Islam, and use Islam as a way to ensure the loyalty of Muslims to the Russian state. So in recent times, there are attempts to limit the travel of Muslims to study abroad because of the fear that they may run into radical preachers there, setting up a whole infrastructure of Muslim spiritual administrations, which control the education and training of imams and muftis. There's some role of the Russian state in the appointment of the chief muftis of the various Muslim spiritual boards. But generally speaking, most of Russia's Muslims are loyal to the Russian state. The Sufis in the North Caucasus, who are being killed by the jihadists, are loyal to the Russian state. They don't want independence for the most part. It's the people who, the Mujahideen, the Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen, are rejecting local Sufism, in part because the local Sufi teachers are considered to be sellouts, having not moved towards
that's happening all over, though, isn't it, Gordon? I mean, that's happening with the Saudi Wahhabis. Their funding in Pakistan are fighting the Sufis in Afghanistan. That's right. Our good friends, the Saudis, at work.
That's a deep theological issue is that the Wahhabis or the Salafists or the Islamists, jihadists, whatever you want to call them, and they're all slightly different things, but they lead and they lead often to the same place, are what some people call highly takfirist. That is, they're very quick to, they have a very strict definition of proper Islam, of what is monotheism. Mm-hmm. And that definition, if you violate those strictures, you're basically excommunicated as a Muslim.
Well, Gordon, we're really run out of time. I just wanted a quick answer on a broader question, which is, ironically, the United States, since the end of the Cold War, has in fact been taking down secular regimes in the Middle East. Saddam Hussein, they're in the process of taking down the secular regime in Syria. We know that Mubarak fell. Obviously, nobody decries, everybody wants democracy in Egypt, but it's being replaced by an Islamic government. So what's going on here in terms of the U.S.'s role here in making openings for radical Islam in Iraq and in Syria?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite put it that they're taking down, the United States is taking down secular regimes, but the United States is not, I think, all too quickly is willing to abandon some of these secular regimes. It's very likely that they're going to be followed by harsh religious regimes that are much more brutal than the secular regimes ever were. And so we're not going to gain in terms of human rights and any possible hope of a move towards democracy, and we're certainly going to be damaging our national security. On the other hand, there's a limit to how much control we have. It's not clear whether if we had backed Mubarak, whether he actually would have survived. In some ways, I think we overstayed our influence in the Muslim world, which is undergoing basically a revolutionary period like Russia and parts of Eastern Europe in the late 19th century. And, you know, we tried to intervene in that case, too. And it didn't work out well. I think we're going to be riding a tiger for a long time. And probably the best thing to do would be to keep our distance and try to guarantee our own security and those of our allies and that of our allies.
Well, Gordon Hahn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. His books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the environmental impact of doing business in the global economy, how much it costs us in terms of natural capital.
The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand, or just won't understand. Yeah, there will be an answer. Let it be. 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 Whisper words of wisdom. Let it be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daphne Wysham, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economic Network. Since 1996, she has worked on research and advocacy at the intersection of climate change, human rights, fossil fuels, international finance, carbon markets, and sustainable economies. Wysham has played a leadership role on Capitol Hill, advising the Congressional Progressive Caucus on a progressive agenda for climate change, and she's currently conducting research around ways in which alternative metrics to the GDP, such as the genuine progress indicators, can be used to build a more sustainable society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daphne Wysham.
Thank you for having me.
And on Earth Day, you have been involved with the idea of, for some time, of coming up with a better indicator than the GDP, the Genual Project, as it's called. And there's also been a report issued by TEEB, which stands for the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity Program, backed by the Group of Eight Economic Powers and the United Nations Environmental Program, that put the cost to the environment of doing business in the global economy of $4.7 trillion a year. And some people have even said it's higher. So give us a sense of how you're chipping away at the kind of global consciousness of this metric that we have, the GDP, which according to these results will literally kill off the planet before, and in doing so, of course, diminish profits.
Yeah, well, what this report found is that the top 100 most profitable corporations would make no profit whatsoever if they actually had to pay the natural capital they get for free. And, you know, when we think about whether it's issues around climate change or nuclear waste or food production, there are all sorts of natural resources that, of course, go into all of those assets as they're being produced. And for the most part, a lot of these environmental costs are externalized on all of us. As Paul Hawken once said, essentially what GDP is stealing from the future, selling it in the present, and calling it GDP. And clearly, you know, that's what we've been doing for decades, and we need to move beyond that because we're stealing the future of our children in the process. So this study, what it did is it began to evaluate the social and environmental costs of a variety of industries, and not surprisingly, at the top of the list in terms of the social and environmental costs that we're all paying is coal mining in both North America and in East Asia. And furthermore, the costs are so high that according to this report, they far outweigh the value that this industry provides to the society. So one thing that, of course, the next question is, well, then what's to be done? Do we need a carbon tax? Do we need some other form of regulation? And what I wanted to draw your listeners' attention to on Earth Day is that some states are actually moving beyond GDP, or gross state product in the case of states, to something called the Genuine Progress Indicator. Maryland and Vermont have both done this. Other states are considering doing the same. And this is a way of sort of, in the case of whether it's the cost of air pollution or water pollution, both putting a shadow price on these pollutants so that policymakers and others get a real sense of what the true costs are. And not just looking at, for example, well, this will result in massive growth in gross state product or gross domestic product, but instead looking at what are the costs and benefits of this particular industry. You get a very different picture when you start to internalize those costs and benefits into the overall equation. And once you can have an honest conversation about those costs and benefits, you can direct policy in a different direction.
So in terms of the cost of getting electricity from coal, coal-fired power generation in East Asia is the worst. It costs an estimated $452.8 billion in natural capital impact per year. Second worst is cattle ranching and farming in South America, that has the second highest regional impact, that is $353.8 billion in natural capital costs compared to $16.6 billion in revenues. And in the United States, coal fire generation in North America has the third highest regional sector impact with an estimated $316.8 billion in natural capital costs compared to $246.7 billion in revenues. So that's the point I was trying to make, Daphne. It looks as if the cost of doing business to the planet is so much greater than the revenues that these companies deriving, and of course they will go down as our resources and planet is depleted.
Yeah, I mean, the important point, of course, is to think, well, if we do internalize these costs, and if we do evaluate these industries through this lens of really factoring in the natural capital costs, how would we change things? How would we make things more sustainable in the long run? And you know, this report, which of course we did not author, this report that talks about just how costly business as usual is. But we did. We are doing a variety of reports and research around the ways in which this new indicator, the Genuine Progress Indicator, can measure the things that we treasure instead of just treasuring the things that we measure the way we do with GDP. You know, when GDP goes up, we think that's a good thing. But what we're not factoring in is the growth in things and in monetary exchanges, is that actually something that we want to increase? For example, just looking in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, GDP went up. Why did it go up? Because there was so much devastation. It was followed by a massive infusion of cash around the reconstruction process. So that doesn't tell us this is something we want to continue to repeat over and over again. But if we were to, for example, measure the costs and benefits of clean water supply, of abundant water that's enhanced by a healthy ecosystem and healthy forests and so on, we would begin to realize the kinds of natural capital that we can continue to preserve and protect and accrue if we protect Mother Earth.
So again, I'm speaking with Daphne Wysham, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economic Network. She's currently conducting research around ways in which alternative metrics to the GDP, such as the Genuine Progress Indicators, can be used to build a more sustainable society. So let's go back, though, and get a definition of natural capital and how it's measured.
Well, if you go to what I would encourage people to do is go to our website, which is genuineprogress.net, and we walk through all of the various indicators that are in place right now in the state of Maryland and in the state of Vermont through this Genuine Progress Indicator. It includes costs that we are paying for in one way or another, whether it's the cost of air pollution or water pollution in the form of asthma or in the form of healthcare costs, rising healthcare costs. It includes the cost of lost farmland and other things that we can actually put we can put a price tag on these things. Not that we're going to be buying and selling them, but we can actually estimate the value and the cost to society overall of these costs that are being externalized on all of us. It goes through the 26 different indicators that have been vetted by economists over several decades, actually, and put them. You can read through our website and see the 26 different indicators, and get a sense of it's not just environmental indicators; it's social indicators like inequality. In fact, our most recent report was on the cost of income inequality to the state of Maryland, and what we found is income inequality has an enormous cost for all of us in the form of course, you know, we pick up the tab if the poor can't pay for their health care. We pick up the tab if they don't get good jobs because they can't afford a good college education. We pick up the tab if there's an increase in crime. So, you know, this is a way of putting a price on the rise in income inequality in the state of Maryland. And what we found is if we were to simply return to the income inequality divide that existed in the late 1960s, the state of Maryland would benefit with roughly $60 billion worth of economic benefits to the state overall, which would be huge for the state. This is more than their annual state budget by a factor of two or three. So what we see is that, you know, there's through this new lens, the genuine progress indicator, we can see costs that otherwise remain invisible to us, including social, environmental, and other economic costs that we haven't put a price tag on.
But I guess, Daphne Wisham, the notion of natural capital, isn't that sort of tied in with what the human species have been doing to this planet since, you know, certainly let's just start with the industrial age, the idea that it's all there to be plundered. And when this country was built, when the railways took over, you know, they used to just shoot bison for fun from the railway carriages, and they almost wiped them out. I spoke yesterday at the LA Times Book Festival with a scientist who's the head of the Jane Goodall Institute at USC, and he was talking about that the gorillas and the great apes are almost down to the last 800 because of coltan mining in the Congo, where they just strip mine the rainforest and dig up holes for this component that's used in electronic gadgetry and is very much in demand. So obviously nobody's factoring in the value of the rainforest in the Congo, let alone the gorillas.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make a clear distinction between, putting a price on nature as in buying and selling and trading it, the way, for example, there's a movement towards buying and selling carbon, and actually putting an economic value on something that is being externalized on all of us, which is a different exercise, and it leads to a different outcome. One leads to essentially continuing to externalize the costs on all of us, but turning it into a profit motive to buy and sell and trade and theoretically to reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions with carbon trading. And what we're seeing is that approach is resulting in abject failure in the EU emissions trading scheme and all sorts of injustices that are being carried out globally. This is different in the sense that this is like a shadow price. It's putting a price on things that we will be paying a cost for generations down the road. It's giving us the long view rather than just the short view, like, you know, this is going to benefit you because you're going to see a growth in GDP. Instead, what we're doing is saying, okay, there will be certain things that will go up, certain indicators that will rise, and others that will decline as a result of a particular approach to development. And it's important for us to not value nature at zero the way it is now, but to actually begin to put a shadow price on it so that we can at least begin the process of having a dialogue on how to treasure, how to measure what we treasure, and not the other way around.
So that is, I take it, why at the top of the list here is global warming, in the sense that that is of all the six top environmental costs, from one, greenhouse gas emission, water use, land use, air pollution, land and water pollution, and waste.
The cost, of course, we're paying the cost of climate change right now, whether it's Hurricane Katrina, Rita, Sandy. We're paying for it with erratic weather, with drought, with, an effect on our infrastructure. The increase in severe weather events means higher insurance payouts. It means more damaged homes. It means we're paying for it in one way or another. How we try to address this in the Genuine Progress Indicator is to assign cost to carbon emissions per ton, and roughly what a variety of economists have come up with is that the cost per ton is pretty close to somewhere around $100 a ton. Now, that's not saying we are going to actually be paying that price if we use this indicator. What we're saying is that's the cost we are now paying in the form of all of these things that I've mentioned previously. It's an incredibly expensive endeavor to continue to burn fossil fuels, and we're beginning to understand just how expensive it is. What we do in internalizing the costs is we have an honest conversation about what those real costs are.
Well, but if we have the honest conversation, of course, we can't even have a conversation about the reality of global warming because of the Koch brothers and others and some of the big oil companies who keep pushing and pumping the denial and funding denial. But obviously, beyond the conversation, what is needed is a carbon tax. I mean, there's a carbon tax that's been put in place in Australia. It was a tremendous political battle to get it through. The mining companies, et cetera, opposed it, and the oil companies, et cetera. But what you're saying is that the pollution is happening, and it's costing us enormously, but nobody's paying for that cost. So if you actually have a carbon tax, then that will get the polluters' attention, won't it?
Well, I mean, okay, so you're taking, I mean, I agree that it's something on the lines of whether it's a carbon tax or a fee and dividend, which is actually something that I would prefer because it's less regressive and it doesn't have the impact on low-income folks that an appropriately high carbon tax would have, and appropriate in the sense of internalizing the actual costs. When I say close to $100 a ton being the actual cost of carbon right now, that would be a huge burden if we were to actually impose that cost on consumers overnight. A fee and dividend begins to send the signal to consumers of fossil fuels that this resource is, in fact, very costly. The dividend would try to address the regressivity of the fee. But this is distinct from a carbon tax. This is essentially saying these are costs that we are now paying. This is how high they are. And we need to respond before we proceed down this path any further by honestly evaluating this cost. It's not an actual price. I'm not saying that an actual price isn't appropriate, but what I'm saying is that this tool is different. It's essentially a shadow price of close to $100 a ton for carbon.
Well, I was meaning that not that the cost should be borne by the consumers, but it should be the cost of doing business. In many ways, it reminds me of the argument that came up during the Obama-Romney campaign, where Obama mentioned that people in this country didn't get wealthy entirely on their own, these big companies and these rich individuals. They didn't do it on their own. Of course, Romney seized on that as though Obama was somehow a socialist and against the virtues of capitalism, when in fact he was just pointing out that there are certain things that make companies operate, make it easy for them because others bear the cost. So that's what my focus is on, you know, a system where this should be a part of the cost of doing business if we're all paying the price.
Yeah, but of course, what does business do? It passes on that cost to the consumer unless there is some way of forcing, for example, Chevron to pay the true cost of oil, they will continue to pass that cost on to us. The question is, how does one move towards internalizing the costs without such a shock to our economic system as to render it sort of incapable of recovery, and especially for the poorest among us? And I think that's where this genuine progress indicator can be useful. It can begin the process of talking about the actual costs. Then we can begin to phase in, ideally, the appropriate policies to address these costs before they become insurmountable. It also, you know, these costs are risks that can mount for industries. For example, water, you know, the cost of using water for rice farming, just to take one example, with an increasingly unpredictable global weather system with climate change, we can see the price of rice go through the roof overnight, as we have in the past with climate change, with rice crops failing. And the same thing goes for wheat. It's resulted in political instability in the Middle East as a result of the record forest fires and peat fires up in Russia. It destroyed an enormous amount of the wheat crop in Russia, and that resulted in the price of bread going up in the Middle East. And of course, then you have, you know, unforeseen consequences that have enormous economic costs. But this attempt to begin to internalize the costs of natural capital is an attempt to also begin to predict some of the sudden shocks that we will be facing in the future if we don't internalize these costs, and also ideally to motivate business to change to address the depletion of natural capital before it all runs out.
Well, Daphne Wysham, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daphne Wysham, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economic Network. Since 1996, she has worked on research and advocacy at the intersection of climate change, human rights, fossil fuels, international finance, carbon markets, and sustainable economies. Daphne Wysham has played a leadership role on Capitol Hill, advising the Congressional Progressive Caucus on a progressive agenda for climate change, and is currently conducting research around ways in which alternative metrics to the GDP, such as the genuine progress indicators, can be used to build a more sustainable society. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck.